Welcome to Power Play for Monday, October 2nd, a tragic day in Las Vegas. The worst shooting in modern U.S. history took place today. A sniper killed 58 people and injured more than 500. It comes on the heels of security concerns right here at home in Canada after a terror attack in Edmonton this week. Here in Ottawa, a very different scene that we all welcomed, one of peace and security, as a historic ceremony unfolded with pomp and ceremony on Parliament Hill. Canada welcomed her 29th Governor General.
I solemnly affirm that you will well and truly serve Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II in the office of Governor General and Commander-in-Chief of Canada and duly impartially administer justice therein.
Je l'affirme solennellement. I do. Oh, and by the way, we shouldn't forget to be happy about celebrating who we are and what we'd like to become.
We'll have more on the Governor General's investiture ahead, and also on today's show, a new leader for the NDP. The charismatic Jagmeet Singh swept to victory on Sunday, taking it all on the first ballot. He's on the show to tell us what's next for his party. And a first for the First Minister's meeting tomorrow. Indigenous leaders will be at the table. AFN Chief Perry Bellegarde will tell us his strategy heading into the big day. And the Conservatives hoping to keep up their momentum, attacking the Liberal tax changes for small businesses. They've launched a new ad, and they're going to be doubling down with it. We'll take a look. But first, a gunman on the Las Vegas Strip rained down bullets from 32 stories up, turning a concert into a killing field. Two Canadians have died and more are believed to be injured. The Department of Foreign Affairs is sending consular officials down to help Canadians who are in Las Vegas today. Here's what Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland had to say.
Mr. Speaker, Canada strongly condemns the horrific attack which took place in Las Vegas that killed and injured so many innocent people. Our thoughts and condolences are with the friends and family of those killed. Canadian consular officials are working closely with U.S. authorities to identify and help any other Canadians hurt by this dreadful attack. And if any Canadians listening are aware of friends and family who may be harmed or caught up in the attack, please do get in touch with Global Affairs immediately. And I think I can say for all members of this House that Canada stands with the United States and with the American people following this terrible attack.
And here in Canada, 30-year-old Somali refugee Abdullahi Hassan Sharif carried out a terror attack in Edmonton. This is what Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale had to say on that attack, which took place late Saturday night.
Mr. Speaker, we are all appalled by the terror attack in Edmonton over the weekend. All Canadians totally condemn such horrible violence. Our thoughts and prayers are indeed with the five victims who were injured. Three have already been released from hospital. Two are still in care. The police investigation is still early but vigorously ongoing, led by the RCMP in close collaboration with Edmonton City Police. As was said by the Prime Minister, by Premier Notley, Mayor Iveson, RCMP Commissioner Dubois, Edmonton Police Chief Connect, and many members in this House today, we will not allow this to divide us, and we will not be intimidated.
Here to help us make sense of the events of the past 48 hours, both in Las Vegas and here at home, former Deputy Commissioner of the RCMP, P.Y. Bourdois, is here, and immigration lawyer Chantal Desloges is joining us from Toronto. P.Y., I want to start with you. You have seen a bit of what unfolded in Vegas today. You could hear the gun firing. You could see people trapped. You understand tactically how these things work. What do you think when you look at this attack of how it was carried out and the largest mass shooting in U.S. history, why this gunman, this sniper, was so terribly successful?
Well, first of all, it's hard to prevent insanity. And that was the case with this particular gunman. He was well positioned where he was located. And the law enforcement agencies that are currently investigating this will, of course, look at the individual's background, what is done, you know, through technology and so on and so forth. But also, I'm curious to find out the weapons used, because obviously it was fully automatic. But I'm also curious about the bullets used, because you have body-piercing bullet. And what you have to bear in mind, tactically speaking, is that from a 32nd floor level and shooting in an open area where you have a number of people, if you have body-piercing bullet that hit the ground, they ricochet and they have a duplicating effect, whereas it's almost like a killing field for this type of situation. It was also a nightmare for law enforcement agencies knowing that where the threat was coming from, but to be able to isolate the threat to a particular room was also, I would imagine, very challenging for the law enforcement agencies involved.
Could something like that happen in Canada?
Well, of course. But again, one has to bear in mind that here in Canada, we have a different public policy with regards to guns and ownership, whereas in Nevada and in other states across the U.S., the accessibility of these types of weapons are a lot easier than it is here in Canada. So, of course, it could happen here in Canada, but I think we have public policies that actually prevent these types of events from unfolding in our midst.
And I want to look back to Canada right now. Of course, the terror attack that was carried out in Edmonton, a man who rammed a police officer, stabbed him. The police officer successfully fought him off, then got into a rented U-Haul, trying to plow down pedestrians, stopped by the Edmonton police. Chantal, we learned that this individual is a Somali refugee who is in Canada. It's raised a lot of questions for people about how he got through the system. We're learning today that he came in 2012. He was granted refugee status in 2012. He was espousing, allegedly, ideologies back in 2015 that drew the attention of the RCMP. Are you concerned that there's a hole in the immigration system that somebody like this made it through?
Well, no, I'm not concerned about that. I mean, in Canada, we have very deeply entrenched beliefs in freedom of thought and freedom of opinion and freedom of speech. So our laws typically are not designed to punish people for holding certain opinions. Where it does punish people is when they cross the line into taking action on those opinions. And I guess the RCMP, for whatever reason, in 2015, when they investigated him, did not find sufficient grounds to believe that he was actually going to act out on his beliefs.
MPY, that's where I want to talk to you, because it's a difficulty if you're a police officer with interviewing people who might be about to carry out an attack. When do you intervene without creating laws that are oppressive, that act when there's too little evidence? But he's on INSET's radar 2 years ago and nothing is done.
Well, again, it's a tragedy. But the fact of the matter is this individual was subject of the RCMP, and he was obviously on the radar. But the problem is to be able to track all of these individuals, because there are limited resources and there are a number of subject of interest. Let's go back to October of 2014, when actually Rouleau, the terrorist that killed the military in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, had been warned by the RCMP 2 weeks prior to this incident that they were actually monitoring him, and yet this tragedy unfolded in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu. Then again, it's a question for the RCMP to prioritize, and where should they put their limited resources. This individual was a subject of interest, but of course there are other pressing issues that INSET, the Integrated National Enforcement Security, have to manage so many different subject of interest that at one point these types of tragedy unfortunately happen at times.
Chantal, he was already through the process, Sharif, of claiming refugee status. He'd done that successfully. I think the question for a lot of people now is, what happens next? Can he be deported to Somalia? Can he stay here in Canada? Does he carry out his jail term here if he's convicted? Obviously, that's way down the road because he has to go through the entire legal process first. But what are the options available to the government immigration-wise?
So as an accepted refugee, basically the government, in order to deport him, would have to declare him to be a public danger. and would have to go through proceedings to show that that's the case. If he is convicted of the crimes that he, well, will be charged with, presumably, then I think that would be a pretty easy argument to make. Also, he would have a chance to defend himself, saying that removal to Somalia would potentially put his life in risk. But the minister would have the opportunity to balance his risk to Canada against his own feeling of risk in Somalia. And I think it's very interesting because, you know, it wasn't that long ago when people were laughing about Kelly Leach's proposals about a Canadian values test. And yet I see a lot of people right now making, you know, what basically is the same proposal to screen people based on beliefs and values as opposed to actions.
PY, last quick question to you. Do the RCMP have enough resources to track all the individuals who they are aware may pose a threat to Canada?
Well, the RCMP has made it quite clear, and the commissioner has indicated that they had to reprofile some of their resources internally from criminal investigation to move them towards national security investigations, leaving huge gaps in these types of investigation with regards to criminal investigation, whereas now you're looking at the fentanyl crisis across the country and the fact that obviously the RCMP and other law enforcement agencies writ large are very short on the criminal investigation sides, and they're trying to address also pressing issues with regards to national security files.
Okay, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you very much to you both for your insight.
Thank you.
After the break, Jagmeet Singh's riding the orange wave. He'll be here to give us the latest on what's next.
Jagmeet Singh, number of votes, 35,266.
Jagmeet Singh, 35,266 votes.
Well, you can certainly feel the excitement there. At long last, the NDP has a new leader, Jagmeet Singh, who swept to victory on the first ballot Sunday afternoon. So what's next after the big win? Well, Mr. Singh joins us in studio. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
You're now the leader of the third federal party, but you don't have a seat in the House of Commons. So what's the plan?
Well, first of all, it's just to absorb the immensity of the situation. It's something I'm incredibly honored by. I'm thankful for the opportunity to serve. And now we're going to get to work. I talked about four pillars during my campaign: inequality, climate change, reconciliation, and electoral reform. Those are going to be the pillars that guide me throughout the work that I'll do now as leader. And I'm going to ensure that our incredible 44 MPs that are in the House will use the tools that we have available in the House to advance these issues and hold the government to account. And then I'll do my work to make sure that this message is brought out to the people across Canada.
When are you going to run for a seat in the House?
So what I've said before is I'm comfortable with the fact that I don't have a seat now, and that other leaders have done incredible work and not being in the House. Jack Layton was a leader that took our party to historic heights and did not have a seat in the House. So I'm comfortable with the fact that I don't right now, but I'm also open to counsel and advice around if an opportunity makes sense, if there's an authentic connection I have with the community, I'll be open to hearing counsel on that.
Are you worried that puts your party at a disadvantage, though, that you're not actually there?
No, because I'll be there in the sense of I'll be able to provide guidance in terms of direction. I'll work with our incredible 44 members to make sure that we have a common vision in terms of where we want to go. And I'm confident in their ability to hold the government to account in the House. And we all know there's so much important work that's done out of the House as well, to take the issues that matter to the people of Canada, but also to hear and listen to people's concerns. So I'll spend my time doing that.
As you know, in Quebec, where the NDP has some pretty strong roots, there can be some pretty serious identity politics. How do you plan to deal with that and to make inroads into Quebec and hold the seats you have and gain more?
Well, what I found throughout my campaign and my experiences in Quebec is one of the most progressive places in Canada. It's a nation that's got incredible progressive policies in place right now, like affordable daycare and affordable tuition for postgraduate, for secondary, post-secondary education. So incredible progressive values. And it's a place where I'm sure that a message that's progressive, that's inspired by making sure that we address inequality is going to connect with the people of Quebec. And I'm confident that it will not only maintain seats in Quebec, but we will grow.
Now, one of the policies I wanted to ask you about that was in your campaign, we didn't hear much on it, but it's very interesting. You talked about drug legalization using the same model as Portugal, which has basically legalized all drugs. Are you going to proceed with that? Are you going to legalize things not only like marijuana, but also cocaine, heroin, hash?
So it's a very specific model. It's the decriminalization, which is an important distinction. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that people aren't prosecuted or charged for possessing personal substances. What we found is people that are being charged right now, that are being put in jail right now for personal possession, are folks that are often faced with mental health issues, faced with addictions, and faced with poverty. Mental health, addiction, and poverty, to me, don't sound like a criminal justice problem. They sound like a social justice problem. So we should solve it with our social justice tools. So instead of using the same resources that we would spend to put people in jail or to prosecute them or to criminalize them, I would say let's use those resources to harm reduction, to support services, to rehabilitation, to actually achieve our goal. If our goal is to reduce the use of illicit substances to save people's lives, then let's have policies that actually achieve those goals.
What are some of the other key policies, if you had to pick top two going in, that you want to see the NDP immediately adopt from your platform?
Electoral reform is fundamental. It would change the face of democracy in Canada. It would allow that people's voice would actually be heard in Ottawa. So not just any form of electoral reform. What people have talked about and people have a broad consensus around is proportional representation, something I fully believe in. Guy Caron did a great job of raising that during the campaign. And most of us, in terms of New Democrats in the leadership race, and in fact, all New Democrats believe that this is an important step forward. I'd also like to see us tackle inequality. And I proposed a couple of income guarantees for seniors to ensure that seniors are lifted out of poverty, the working poor, as well as Canadians living with disabilities. I think that would be an incredible step forward in making the lives of people better.
I want to ask you about your win again.
Sure.
And to go back to that, over 50% on the first ballot, most people didn't think anybody could pull that off. How did you do it?
Well, this is something that was really important to me, that we didn't only inspire or recruit new members, but we also spent a lot of time speaking with and engaging existing membership. And the result is testament to the fact that we had an incredible team that did both. We spent time speaking with existing memberships, hearing their concerns, connecting with them, and also spent a lot of time inspiring new memberships and signing up and recruiting new members. So I think it's a combination of those two, and I'm incredibly honored by that phenomenal mandate.
I'd also like to get your take on the events of the last 48 hours, what happened both in Las Vegas and in Edmonton. Of course, there's always concerns after this, number one, about security, number two, about backlash. How do you address those as the NDP leader to people in Canada who are both worried about being safe and those who are saying, look, we need to really focus on maintaining our diversity and our openness?
Well, we absolutely need to denounce these acts of terror, these acts of violence, heinous, unacceptable. We also need to make sure that in response to that, we support and double down on our society, which is inclusive, which is accepting, and we don't allow hate to grow. Hate, once allowed to grow, we all know it's something that spreads like a fire. And once we say it's okay to hate someone based on their ethnic origin or their religion, it'll move into gender, sexuality, and other forms. So we can't allow hate to grow. We need to protect, of course, our citizens, the people that live in our country, but we also need to make sure that we don't allow the climate of hate to exist.
Jagmeet Singh, congratulations again on your big win, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, how did Singh pull it off behind the scenes? Our NDP expert, Carl Bellanger, is here. You know everything, Carl, I think, that's going on in the NDP at any given time. So this was a fascinating win because it was a first ballot. Most people didn't think anyone was going to get over 50%. That happened. What's the secret?
Well, to be fair, the last time I was on your network, I said it was a 50-50 chance. And if there's anyone who could pull it off, it would be Jagmeet Singh.
You did say that.
I did say
that. You were right.
And the reason for that is because he seemed to have the best organization on the ground. He seemed to be better positioned to pull the vote. And when you saw the turnout show up, and the turnout was about 50%, you know, a little more than 50%, which is on par for a leadership race of a one member, one vote model, you knew that the others would have a hard time to be close to him because he had so much organization strength on the ground. Now, one of the problems that the others had is that they wanted a bigger turnout, but they were not able to pull votes. And if it did not happen organically, the conditions were set for Jagmeet Singh to win on the first ballot.
Well, you know, he didn't just win on the first ballot. He blew everybody else out of the water. This was not a small margin. It was pretty spectacular, the gap between first and second. Is that something that anyone in the party had a sense was going to happen to that degree?
I don't think so. I think everybody thought that Charlie Angus would be much closer to Mr. Singh. I think that even he was surprised at the results. I think the people in his campaign were telling me that they thought they had a shot at winning, obviously, but they thought also they could. They were very competitive in Ontario and BC. It seems obvious by the results that those were disappointing numbers for Charlie Angus in his campaign, and it allowed Mr. Singh to pull ahead by that kind of margin.
What do you attribute that to? What's the appetite in the party that has created that big of a gap between the front runner and Charlie Angus, who is very well known and well liked?
Well, I suppose there's an appetite for something different. And if there's somebody that was offering something different during this campaign, it was Jagmeet Singh. Clearly, having contrast, with the other candidates, but also with Justin Trudeau, while playing on the same kind of turf as Justin Trudeau in hope to regain the ground that was lost to the Liberals in the last campaign. So we have now a younger leader, younger than Mr. Trudeau, who's now the old man out. and so we'll see what happens in 2019, but the NDP is certainly making a play to improve on their current standing.
How dangerous is Jagmeet Singh to Justin Trudeau's majority?
Well, he is quite dangerous. I think a Liberal organizer, especially in the Greater Toronto Area, in the Greater Vancouver Area, are looking at Mr. Singh at possibly making inroads there. He has made inroads as an Ontario MPP, winning his seat in Brampton. And so, we could have coattails and create conditions for NDP seats there in ridings where the party was not usually competitive. The Liberals are looking at Quebec, however, as a possibility for a recovery of those losses, and they hope that Quebecers will react negatively to that. And so is the Bloc Québécois, by the way, who have already started pretty nasty attacks against Mr. Singh even 2 weeks ago. The leader of the Bloc was talking about the rise of the extreme religious left, which was, pretty gross, if you want my honest opinion. So Mr. Trudeau is going to be worried about Mr. Singh for sure. He's a new player in town. Mr. Scheer has a bit of a smile going on right now because he knows that having a strong NDP is good for the fortune of the Conservative Party, and it will make for a very interesting race in 2019.
Carl, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Well, what's your thoughts on the new NDP leader? We'd love to know, so please make sure to reach out to us through social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also contact us via email. Our address is powerplay@ctvnews.ca. Coming up, the Tories are taking aim at taxes. We'll have more on that just ahead. Welcome back. It's time for our Monday strategy session. Joining me from Toronto is Michelle Austin, a senior advisor with Summa Strategies. And here in studio is Marianne Carter with Environics Communications and Greg Weston with Earnscliff Strategy Group. Well, the Tories are doubling down on their tactic, which they seem to think is successful so far, of attack ads. And in fact, they have a new ad coming out. Let's just take a little peek at it before we start the discussion to see exactly what it looks like. Here it is.
The Trudeau Liberals are threatening local businesses with big new tax hikes. Now, I won't just stand by and let the Liberals drive them into the ground. I'm Andrew Scheer. That's who I am, and that's why I'm fighting to save local business. Join me by going to savelocalbusiness.ca.
Okay, I'm going to start with you on this one, Greg. What do you think? Is that going to be effective?
Well, the interesting thing about that ad, Mercedes, is most people will be more curious about Andrew Scheer than they were about the content of the ad. They're kind of watching him, and this may be the first time that a lot of them will actually sort of go, oh, okay, that's him by himself. So it would be really interesting to do focus groups after that and say, what did you remember of the message, which was the attack ad, and how much did you remember of Andrew Scheer? I suspect most people will have formed an impression of Andrew Scheer.
Is that a bad thing? If they're not paying so much attention to the ad as they are to getting to know the leader, is that equally part of the strategy here?
Yeah, and I think part of it is that this issue is not going away, right? And Andrew Scheer is going to capitalize on this as much as he can. I think having this ad right after consultations have ended is very, very strategic on the Conservatives' part. And if you've watched Question Period, they're just narrowing in on this. They're not letting it go. And we continue to see across the country that people are still quite upset. So I think it's only going to bolster him in many ways.
Michelle, I was talking to one of the strategists from another day of the week. He's a Liberal, and he said, look, coming back from Nova Scotia this weekend, he heard a lot of anger from people out there about this, that the issue seems to be sticking. Are ads the next logical step for the Conservatives here?
Well, of course, they're the next logical step for the Conservatives because, as you said, the story has legs. But the other thing that makes it fantastic for the Conservatives is this is battleground that Andrew Scheer is comfortable on. This is something he can talk to whether or not he's in front of the cameras or whether he's just talking to local businesses. So it's a bit of a stars aligned for Andrew Scheer in that he can get all of these things accomplished in one ad and, as Greg says, sort of introduce himself to the larger political audience in Canada.
Okay, well, we just had Jagmeet Singh on the show, of course, the new NDP leader. One of the questions we were asking him, Greg, is, look, you're a new leader of a federal party, but you don't have a house, don't have a seat in the House. He doesn't seem to think that's a big idea, a big problem. Is it really not a big deal, or is it actually problematic when your leader is not in the House of Commons to provide that leadership?
Depends what you want to do. He has 2 years to prepare the party for an election, and they're not in great shape. He has to go out. He has to get all of those or all of his organizations together. He has to go out and raise a whole pile of money. So the question is, where is he going to be of most value? Being in the House of Commons is a nice way to get your face on television each night, but he can do that when he's in town. Today he had a scrum afterwards, and I'm pretty sure all of the networks carried at least 5 minutes of him. He didn't appear in the Commons. He'd probably get more airtime not being there, so he can still get his airtime. But the big thing is he can get out there, and he has to go around from riding to riding to riding. He's on the rubber chicken circuit now, and there's no way around it.
Well, and that was very much the Justin Trudeau Liberal strategy, was that they didn't think that being in the House was the most important thing, but he actually had a seat in the House.
He had a seat, but he wasn't there either.
Yeah. How does that work? Does he fly in every week for caucus? How does he deal with the fact that he's a leader who has not yet been elected?
Well, look, the other way you can look at this, though, is that the party has been looking for a new leader and anticipating this for a number of months now, and I think we can agree that Mr. Singh represents a new direction of the party. He had a significant landslide. And so while, you know, he could have boots on the ground and, you know, working outside of the House, people are ready to see him shine. And I think they're also ready to maybe not see Tom Mulcair anymore or see the new face of the party. And so if he's not going to be in Ottawa, I think there leaves a lot of unanswered questions of who's going to be taking questions in question period and who's really going to be that face here.
Is that one of the things they're trying to figure out right now, Michelle, behind the scenes? Where is he going to run? How quickly can they get him in? Are they really not concerned about this? Or is it just kind of tread water until they can get him into the House and get him confronting Trudeau?
Well, I don't think he's treading water. I think he's exactly where he wants to be. We live in this Kim Kardashian world where everybody likes to be outside of their workspaces and performing. And he's obviously doing that very well. And he won a decisive victory over his caucus colleagues who ran against him. So he is going to have to do a little bit of juggling and make sure that everybody that he ran against is still happy in his caucus and his caucus is performing well, because he wants the NDP to be strong heading into the next election. But I think he's perfectly happy to be outside of the House of Commons, and I don't think there's any rush whatsoever for him to get there.
Some interesting developments in the Senate as well that we want to talk about that are not a scandal, usually when the Senate comes up. But in this case, it's actually that the independents, or as some people consider them, the so-called independents, quote unquote, now have the same number of senators as the Conservatives do. So the Conservatives before could make life pretty difficult for the Liberals if they wanted to in the Senate, and they did on a number of occasions. A lot of people say the independents are really Liberals. Mm-hmm. Greg, what does this mean strategically for the government's ability to get legislation through the Senate?
I don't think it's a problem. The government really hasn't had all that much trouble getting its legislation through the Senate, even when the Conservatives had a majority there. So if the Conservatives aren't going to block it, the chances of the independents that were actually, as you said, a lot of them are Liberal appointees, blocking it is fairly limited. I think the average person out there is just saying, you know, Why don't we have them all independents? And the fact of the matter is, if they were all independents, they would represent what they're supposed to represent in the first, which is the different regions of the country in this chamber of sober second thought, rather than becoming just another level of partisanship. I think people have got enough of that going on in the House of Commons. And if the Senate wants to be taken seriously, I think they would probably behoove them to behave a little less partisan anyway. So I think it's a good thing.
Marianne, have you seen that so far from these independent senators? Are they really independent?
Well, I think some of them are still somewhat jaded from the fact that they were told they're no longer part of the Liberal caucus. And while, you know, I think Trudeau has done what he's sought out to achieve, this is a very old institution, and the role of the Senate is to correct mistakes, scrutinize legislation. And I don't know down the road how this will work if they need to pass a really contentious bill in the House, and you have a group of independent senators who are divided on a particular issue, how that will actually pan out. And, you know, you're putting very, very modern practices into a very old institution. So I don't know, you know, if this is going to cause problems down the road, or we can see more thoughtful debate.
Michelle, when you're thinking about this, are the Tories now, have they lost sort of that one advantage they had of having the majority in the Senate? Or was it that really the Senate would never dare truly stop something by the elected House?
Well, why would you bite the hand that appointed you? Of course, this day was coming. We all knew that the Conservatives would obviously not be appointed anymore. But I mean, to think that this is an independent body is complete baloney. You have basically now two Liberal caucuses in the Senate. The independents, I don't think, have voted for a second against the government, nor do I expect them to in the future. So, you know, the Trudeau government's running away from democratic reform. Their attempts to do it with Miriam Monsef as the minister completely scared them off. So I don't think we're going to see a moment of change in the Senate in terms of how it votes. The committees are still doing great work, but the so-called independent senators are really Liberals. And what else would we expect them to be?
Okay, well, we're certainly going to be keeping a close eye on it. Thank you very much to our Monday strategist for joining us.
Thanks, Mercedes.
Thanks, Mercedes.
Thanks, Mercedes.
After the break, previewing the Indigenous agenda for tomorrow's First Minister's meeting.
Michelle and Harold, the elders and the creator for this beautiful day.
Welcome back to the show. The First Ministers meet in Ottawa tomorrow, and for the first time, Indigenous leaders are going to be at the table with them. For more on this historic moment, Perry Bellegarde is here. Obviously, this is a step forward, many people believe, for Indigenous leaders and Indigenous communities. What is your priority sitting down at the table, and how much of a difference do you think being present is going to make?
Well, I think it's going to make a huge difference, us being at the table. A couple of priorities. In Canada, you've got an aging workforce. You know, and in Canada, you also have the fastest growing segment of Canada's population is young First Nations men and women. So investing in education and skills training, that's going to be the priority. So labor, investing in human capital, you're going to have huge returns on investment. So that's going to be one of the messages. And studies have shown that if you can get First Nations people educated and trained and working, you're going to have a really positive overall GDP growth on the economy. That's one of the priorities.
Now, when you head into this meeting, how hard did you have to fight to get a place at the table?
Well, this one, it's wasn't that hard, you know, but we want to make sure that we're there at all future meetings, all FedProv tables. You know, it just makes sense, you know, because it's 2017. Now, you know, like I think one of the other items we're going to talk about is North America Free Trade Agreement, you know, and the Indigenous Peoples Chapter. And people are saying, well, why is that important? Well, in 2017, you think about NAFTA, it's been there since 1994. Well, 1994, you didn't have the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. You didn't have recent Supreme Court decisions like the Chilcotin case that respects Aboriginal rights and title. So to create economic certainty, to create economic stability, you need to involve Indigenous peoples. So NAFTA part is going to be part of that dialogue. And then having access to capital, you know, has always been a hurdle for First Nations people. We want to invest in some of these big mega projects, you know, all of these things. And there could be some policy and legislative changes that can happen as well to foster growth in the economy and to make sure that there's key strategic partnerships between First Nations and private sector companies as well. So there's a number of things we can talk about.
You mentioned NAFTA, and I think that's so interesting. Is this something that the government has already engaged with you on, or is this going to be the first opportunity to talk about that Indigenous interests and role?
Well, with the federal government, we're there, and of course, we're supporting Minister Chrystia Freeland. She's doing an excellent job. Canada's well prepared going to those rounds in negotiating a new deal with USA and Mexico. First opportunity with the premiers and to encourage them to support the Indigenous Peoples Chapter, because it does make economic sense, because it's going to create economic stability in the provinces. And that's really good for everyone in, across Canada.
When you're at the table and you're representing, you know, in your case, AFN, there's a number of other leaders who are there too. Do you walk in and do you talk about some priorities that you all want to present together? Or is each group listing out their own priorities as that particular Indigenous group, yours for AFN, someone else, for example, from the North might be very different?
Well, you got to respect the diversity that's there. You know, like you think of the 203 First Nations in British Columbia, they have issues regarding the fishing industry, you know, fisheries. Same thing on the with First Nations on the East Coast. But the softwood lumber issue, well, we have First Nations people that are affected by that industry. And you can go province by province by province by province, territory by territory. Indigenous peoples need to be involved, and there should be enough flexibility. And I think the premiers are open-minded enough and big enough to start establishing those respectful relationships with the chiefs and leadership in their in their territories, because they're the rights and title holders. So they've got to be at the table with the premiers and their cabinets on a regular basis to foster that space for dialogue, even bringing together corporate circles, private sector, public sector, and First Nations together to find that common ground and the balance between the economy and the environment. All that can happen, but you need the space to talk.
Oh, just have a minute left, but I think that's the difficult question, is it's one thing to be at the table. It's something else to know that your voice is carrying equal weight to that of the premiers. Are you confident that's going to be the case?
Well, we're going to keep pushing. Like, this is a very rushed meeting, and it's a focus on the economy. I think there's going to be an ongoing need for further meetings and further dialogue, and to make sure that First Nations people are at there every step of the way. Like, we haven't had a First Minister's meeting since 1987 to deal with the Constitution in Section 35, which recognizes existing Aboriginal and treaty rights. So we have not had those meetings since then. So I think it's an opportune time. And I think if we can get those systems in place and those processes and meetings going forward, we're going to create a better Canada for everybody, because it's going to respect Indigenous rights and title and jurisdictions.
National Chief Perry Bellegarde, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Good luck tomorrow.
Thanks.
After the break, it's the Monday Press Gallery with Joyce Napier and John Iveson. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Let's bring in our Monday Press Gallery for their look at some of the day's biggest political stories. Joyce Napier, of course, is CTV's Ottawa Bureau Chief, and John Iveson is a columnist for the National Post. There is, of course, a new Governor General today. Her Excellency Julie Payette was installed. That is the official term. We're not using a weird word. It's called the installment of the Governor General, which was something I learned, not sworn in. Some people looking at who was there, of course, many of the heavyweights of Canadian politics, previous Governor General Adrian Clarkson was there. One person who was not, Andrew Scheer, leader of the Conservative Party, wasn't present. The Conservatives say he had a longstanding prior engagement. Do you find that a bit odd, Joyce, that he wouldn't attend?
Well, I don't know, because he was the only one that wasn't there. We have some former prime ministers. Stephen Harper, I believe, wasn't there. Paul Martin wasn't there. So maybe they also had previous engagements. I don't know if the leader of the official opposition has to be there, but he is Her Majesty's loyal opposition. So maybe, I don't know what the protocol is. I don't follow these things very closely. I have other things to say about the GG as to why are people not at her installment. But maybe it is odd. I mean, it's not like we didn't know that it was today.
It wasn't a surprise.
Maybe there's no room for them because they were packed in there. I mean, just about anybody who was anybody was there. All the Supreme Court justices, Chief of Defence Staff, all the Aboriginal leaders, so maybe they just wasn't a secret.
No, the Conservatives were represented. It just wasn't the leader, which was a little bit different.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think he was missed particularly. I mean, it's not like he had a role to play, so...
Okay, well, thoughts on the new Governor General. Joyce, going to start with you because I know you have lots of thoughts on the Governor General.
I thought her speech was absolutely brilliant. I mean, here is someone, and we're not used to that here in Ottawa because usually speeches are well prepared, and I'm sure hers was well prepared, but she did not have a teleprompter, she did not have notes, and she gave a bilingual speech, in fact, a trilingual speech at times, and it felt more genuine than the speeches we usually hear on the Hill. And I thought that was quite interesting as to why, you know, we need a Governor General and all that. I'll leave that for another time. But she certainly did a good job communicating who she was and what she intended to do. And I thought that was pretty brilliant.
I think she could have done with a script.
Look at that. I disagree.
We don't often, but this one, I think it rambled a little bit. And, you know, people have scripts for a reason because it provides them with a structure. And I think this was a little bit unstructured. It went from her recollections of her days as an astronaut through her pride in her origins with her family. And it left me thinking, well, what was the message she was trying to get out? I think what I took away from it was that... especially from her coat of arms with the motto, which is through hardship, the stars. There is going to be an educational theme to this Governor Generalship. I think the pitfalls are that she gets drawn into the Liberal Party's agenda. She was clearly appointed by them. They see her as a reflection of the values which they've claimed as their own.
I heard the science and evidence-based decision-making.
Right, and she's an agent of change, the Prime Minister said. Well, an agent of the change that he wants to see. So I think she's got to be the Governor-General for all Canadians. She's got to step back from that a little bit. You know, David Johnson did an admirable job, given the fact that he had two very different Prime Ministers and he did not fall into the policy trap of them. I think Michael Jean before that could possibly be accused, certainly when Harper was Prime Minister, of being... slightly offside with the government. There was a famous occasion where she made comments that sounded like criticism of his justice agenda. So that's going forward, she's got to be wary of being seen to be too close to one side rather than the other.
A very different kind of Governor General than David Johnson was.
Yes, definitely a very different one. And it was interesting that her son was there sitting next to her, and she spoke about her son, which, you know, as a mom, and there are a lot of moms in the audience and listening, touching that she asked him for his permission because it changes his life as well quite a bit, right?
Right. Well, and speaking of things that are going to change lives, possibly the First Minister's meeting tomorrow. I don't know. We might get too excited about that. They're going into it the first time that Indigenous leaders have been at the table as well. John, obviously there's some big topics here, everything from NAFTA to marijuana on the table. Where are the flashpoints?
Well, I don't think much will get achieved at all because you've got so many people at the table. How are they ever going to reach any conclusion about anything? But clearly, the pot is going to be a big issue. You know, the government came out with this July 1st deadline and then essentially said, turned to the provinces and said, here you go. Make sure you get on with it as far as the legalities of it, the distribution of it. I mean, there are so many things to be done. So the provinces will be howling about that, I'm sure. These tax reforms are not going down well. A lot of provinces are very upset by them. On the other side, they're going to hear a lot about NAFTA, get an update as to where they are with NAFTA. But again, nothing much can be done from the provincial level. So I think there'll be a lot of talking and not too many decisions made.
Well, they're certainly going to talk about NAFTA, but I think NAFTA is one of the issues where they're all pretty much on the same page, right? This is Team Canada. So we're still, you know, the premiers are still on board. On marijuana, perhaps they're going to tell the government, we're not ready. The way the chiefs of police have told the committee already, Canada is not ready for this. The provinces are not ready for this. But on the tax... the Prime Minister will get an earful from the provinces because many provinces now have said these new tax reforms or these new tax changes for small and medium businesses don't sit well with the premiers. And they're certainly going to tell the Prime Minister that, and they're going to tell the Finance Minister that. And earlier today, we spoke to Brian Pallister, the Premier of Manitoba, and this is what he had to say about it. I think we have a clip of it.
We do.
Ill thought out, ill conceived, and ill timed move by the federal government to have us have a class warfare discussion about tax hikes on small and medium sized enterprises. I think that's wrong on many levels. It's wrong in the tone, It needs to be changed to a respectful discussion on what our possibilities could be on a fairer tax system.
So, John, something's getting traction, not just for the Tories federally.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a reason Stephen Harper never held these meetings, because everybody's got their own agenda. And they're all going to come out and complain about the federal government at the end of it, because they're probably not going to get what they want. So, yeah, I think that these are domestic political issues within the provinces, and they obviously are going to play nationally too.
But, you know, this tax issue is not something that the Trudeau government will be able to fix by telling the provinces, here, we're going to give you some money. Because when the federal government wants to fix things, here, throw money at the provinces, and they'll go away happy. They're not happy about this tax. These new tax changes, it hurts their small businesses. They've been told they got an earful. The MPs going back in their riding are getting it. Like, they're getting it from all sides. And they're going to hear it tomorrow from premiers. I mean, you know, Brian Pallister was pretty clear on what he thought. And he said, starting this class warfare is not on either. So they're going to have a chat about that, for sure.
John, final word to you.
Well, I never have any great expectations about First Minister's meeting, because it tends to be a lot of talking and not much action.
Oh, here we were getting all excited, and you let all the air out of the
balloon. No, I'm a typical
journalist. Well, thank you very much to our Monday journalists. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you.
And that's your look at today's Power Plays. Scott Laurie is up next with the latest headlines. For the Power Play team, I'm Mercedes Stevenson, and we hope Don Martin, if you're watching this at home, he will be feeling better tomorrow and back here right at this time on CTV News Channel. Until then, have a great evening, and thanks for watching.